From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
One of the enduring problems of our political system, whether it's about Democrats or Republicans, is the role of corporations in the political process.
Barack Obama is ready to be president of the United States.
But isn't this open to the delegates?
No, it's not. You can talk to the
police
right
now. This is not for the Democratic National Convention.
That's why we have to have alternative parties and alternative voices.
We're in Denver, Colorado. We marched to protest the Democratic National Convention.
The time is now to unite as a single party with a single purpose.
It's a simple yes or no. Do you think they should be banned? Blackwater, the mercenary company, from operating in Iraq.
No, I don't think they should be banned.
Barack Obama has the courage to go overseas, to go to Iraq, into a war zone and see what's going on there, but he doesn't seem to have the courage to face our returning anti-
Breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. Today, part one, highlights of the Democratic convention from the suites to the streets to the convention floor. Then an interview with Robert Kennedy Jr. But first, U.S. airstrikes have tripled civilian deaths in Afghanistan. We get the latest, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. It's great to be home. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. government has seized control of the mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in what could become the largest corporate bailout ever. The Treasury Department's pledge to provide as much as $200 billion to the companies as they cope with heavy losses on mortgage defaults. The two quasi-public companies own or guarantee just under half the country's $12 trillion in mortgage debt. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced the bailout.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are so large and so interwoven in our financial system that a failure of either of them would cause great turmoil in the financial markets here at home and around the globe. This turmoil would directly and negatively impact household wealth, from family budgets to home values to savings for college and retirement.
The Republican and Democratic presidential nominees John McCain and Barack Obama both supported the bailout. Obama said the government needs to take steps to guard against Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ultimately profiting from the government assistance.
We have to protect taxpayers, not bail out the shareholders and management of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This is a challenging situation that's been festering for a long time. There are some community and regional banks with potential exposure, including those serving low-income communities. We're going to have to carefully address those situations. But we must not allow government intervention to protect investors and speculators who relied on the government to reap massive profits.
In other economic news, the nation's unemployment rate has reached 6.1%, a five-year high. The unemployment rate for African Americans is now in double digits at 10.6%. Meanwhile, in Nevada, regulators shut down Silver State Bank Friday. It's the 11th bank failure this year. Civilian deaths in Afghanistan from U.S. and NATO airstrikes have nearly tripled from 2006 to 2007. This according to a new Human Rights Watch report. Airstrikes killed at least 321 civilians in 2007, compared with at least 116 in 2006. The tally for this year is expected to be even higher. We'll have more on that story after headlines. Meanwhile, the top commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, Army General Jeffrey Schlosser, said Friday he needed thousands of additional troops to combat violence along the border with Pakistan. Earlier today, missiles fired by U.S. drones killed at least 17 people in Pakistani village near the Afghan border. Local residents said the two drones fired three missiles at a house and a madrasa. Doctors said 15 to 20 people were also wounded, most of them women and children. Last week, U.S. commandos carried out a helicopter-borne ground assault in what was the first known incursion into Pakistan by U.S. troops since the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Hussein Haqqani, Pakistan's ambassador to the United States, condemned the ground assault that killed 20 people.
Pakistan and the United States are partners in the war against terror. It does not suit the United States to enrage Pakistani people by unilateral actions, especially when those unilateral actions do not yield anything by way of getting any significant terrorists or militants. It is much better to let Pakistan act on its side of the border and to continue the cooperative relationship between Pakistan, NATO, and the United States.
Pakistani lawmakers have elected Asif Ali Zardari, the widower of the assassinated former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, to become Pakistan's next president, replacing General Pervez Musharraf, who resigned last month.
Today, Pakistan People's Party has completed a great roadblock, has gone over a great roadblock to complete the democratic process. I congratulate the nation, I congratulate the parliaments. It is the philosophy of Shaheed Mohtarma Benazir Bhutto, in which we believe, which says democracy is the best revenge. The revenge from the dictators in the form of democracy.
Asif Ali Zardari has little experience governing and has spent 11 years in jail on corruption charges. He'll be sworn in on Tuesday. In campaign news, a video has emerged of Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin telling ministry students at her former church that the U.S. invasion of Iraq is a task from God.
Pray for our military men and women who are striving to do what is right also for this country, that our leaders, our national leaders, are sending them out on a task that is from God. That's what we have to make sure that we're praying for, that there is a plan and that that plan is God's plan. So bless them with your prayers, your prayers of protection over our soldiers.
During the same address, Palin said the construction of a new oil pipeline in Alaska is God's will.
I can do my part in doing things like working really, really hard to get a natural gas pipeline, about a $30 billion project that's going to create a lot of jobs for Alaskans, and we'll have a lot of energy flowing through here. And pray about that also. I think God's will has to be done in unifying people and companies to get that gas line built. So pray for that.
The video of her speech was originally posted on the Wasilla Assembly of God's website. Meanwhile, the National Jewish Democratic Council has criticized Palin as being a poor choice to be vice president. The group described Palin to be, quote, totally out of step with Jewish public opinion. Just weeks before McCain tapped her to be his running mate, the executive director of Jews for Jesus, David Brickner, spoke at Palin's church and blamed Middle East violence in part on Israeli Jews who didn't accept Jesus. A spokesperson for McCain said Palin attended the sermon, but that she did not share his views. On Sunday, Barack Obama, John McCain, and Joe Biden all gave lengthy broadcast interviews on the morning talk shows, but Sarah Palin was nowhere to be seen. Since being named McCain's running mate 10 days ago, Palin's only interview has been with People magazine. During her campaign stop, she's also refused to take questions from voters. On Sunday, the McCain campaign announced Palin will sit down for multiple interviews with Charles Gibson of ABC in Alaska over 2 days, most likely Thursday and Friday. The campaign has not announced when Palin will give her first live interview. The BBC is reporting two Polish intelligence sources have for the first time confirmed the CIA ran a secret prison facility on Polish soil. One officer said the CIA used a secure site far from major towns that was close to a former military airport. In the state of Georgia, a county judge has issued an order for Troy Davis to be executed on September 23rd. Last July, Davis came within 24 hours of execution before receiving a temporary stay. In 1991, Davis was convicted of murdering a white police officer, but since then, many questions have been raised about his case. The murder weapon was never found. There's no DNA evidence or other physical evidence. 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses said they were coerced by police and have since recanted their testimony. Amnesty International has condemned the police in St. Paul, Minnesota, for deploying unnecessary and disproportionate use of non-lethal weapons on peaceful protesters during last week's Republican National Convention. Police fired rubber bullets and used batons, pepper spray, tear gas canisters, and concussion grenades on peaceful demonstrations. Amnesty said some of the police actions appear to have breached United Nations standards and U.S. laws on the use of force by law enforcement officials. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports taxpayers in St. Paul should be off the hook for any damages stemming from claims of police misconduct related to the Republican National Convention. As part of a deal with the city, the Republican Party's host committee bought insurance covering up to $10 million in damages and unlimited legal costs for lawsuits against the police. In St. Paul, some critics say the agreement only encouraged police to use aggressive tactics knowing they won't have to pay damages. The Financial Times reports the U.S. military provided combat training to 80 Georgian Special Forces commandos only months prior to Georgia's army assault on South Ossetia in August. The training was provided by senior U.S. soldiers and two private military contractors, MPRI and American Systems, both based in Virginia. The revelation could add fuel to accusations by Russia that the U.S. had orchestrated the war in the Georgian enclave. A former Halliburton executive has pleaded guilty to orchestrating more than $180 million in bribes to senior Nigerian government officials. Albert Stanley used the bribes to help Halliburton win a contract to build a $6 billion liquefied natural gas plant in Nigeria. Several of the bribes were paid during the time when Vice President Dick Cheney led Halliburton. In labor news, 27,000 workers at Boeing have gone on strike after contract talks broke down over pay, pensions, and job security. The striking workers are represented by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. And a top UN official is urging people to eat less meat in an effort to tackle climate change. Rajendra Pachauri, the chair of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Pachauri told the London Observer, quote, in terms of immediacy of action and the feasibility of bringing about reductions in a short period of time, it clearly is the most attractive opportunity. The animal welfare group Compassion and World Farming has calculated that if the average British household cut their meat consumption in half, it would cut greenhouse gas emissions more than if car use was cut in half. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The top U.S. military commander in Afghanistan has called for an investigation into reports that over 90 civilians were killed in U.S. airstrikes on Afghan villages last month. General David McKiernan requested a review of the American military investigation into the attacks Sunday, citing emerging evidence. He did not elaborate on the evidence, but Afghan and Western officials have told journalists there's video from the aftermath of the August 22nd airstrike that shows dozens of dead civilians. The Afghan government and the UN mission in Afghanistan both concurred with villagers' reports that at least 90 civilians, two-thirds of them children, were killed in the airstrike. But the initial U.S. military investigation released Tuesday concluded that no more than 42 people had been killed, of which only 7 were civilians, the rest Taliban. Afghan President Hamid Karzai visited the affected village of Azizabad on Thursday. He paid his respect to the mourners and condemned the airstrikes.
I have been working day and night over the past 5 years to prevent such incidents. But I haven't been successful in my efforts. If I had succeeded, the people of Azizabad wouldn't be bathed in blood.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has also ordered a review of whether the U.S. and NATO should be allowed to use airstrikes and carry out raids in villages. The August 22nd attack is only one in a series of U.S. and NATO airstrikes that have caused high numbers of civilian deaths. According to a new report from Human Rights Watch, the increased use of airstrikes has tripled civilian deaths in Afghanistan over the past year. Last week, hundreds protested an airstrike in Kabul that reportedly killed 3 members of a family, a man named Nurullah and 2 of his infant sons, one of whom was only 8 months old. This is Salman Shah, a relative of the 3 victims.
Are those 2 children Al-Qaeda or Taliban? Do they have guns to fight? Why should they be killed? This proves that these Americans, these Christians, are here to kill a generation of Afghans.
Kathy Gannon is an award-winning Associated Press correspondent who's covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for over 2 decades. She's the author of Eye is for Infidel, From Holy War to Holy Terror, 18 Years Inside Afghanistan. Kathy Gannon joins me now on the line from Islamabad, Pakistan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
It's good to have you with us. You have just written a piece called Afghans Fed Up with Government U.S. Explain what you have found in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I just got back actually from Afghanistan. I traveled around quite extensively in the east, in Nangarhar, eastern Nangarhar province, and in northeastern Kunar province. And really, you know, I mean, without exception, everyone I spoke to were so frustrated after 7 years with the way with the corruption in their own government and the lawlessness that exists in Afghanistan, and with the heavy-handed approach of the U.S. and coalition and NATO forces in terms of airstrikes, in terms of errant raids, in terms of picking up people for questioning, picking up people who they think are suspicious, that fit a profile. There was just a tremendous degree of frustration because these are people who really were happy to see the back of the Taliban and really are not, don't want to embrace the Taliban. But they are so frustrated and so fed up. And one old guy said to me, he says, you know, where can I go? He says, you know, I'm almost afraid to sleep at night because somebody's going to come into my house and take my sons. So it's been 7 years. And while it's a very difficult operation and a difficult place in which to operate, after 7 years, instead of people feeling that it's moving in the right direction, there's just such a degree of frustration which contradicts the tremendous hope that they did have at one point.
Mm. Civilian deaths now, according to Human Rights Watch, which put out a report today, have nearly tripled since 2006. The tally for this year expected to be even higher.
Yeah, you know, it's hugely problematic because the use of airstrikes as a backup, as to target houses is inevitably inaccurate and has proven to be inaccurate. And what one person was saying to me is that, you know, it's the strategy is between, you know, well, the use of airstrikes to save on the lives of the international soldiers versus not using them, which would reduce the number of Afghan civilian deaths. And so the choice is made, and the choice is made to use the strikes. And it's not that they intentionally target civilians, of course not. But the thing is if you drop a bomb on a house and then you say, oh, well, they shouldn't have been hiding among those people. Well, you know you're going to have civilian casualties. These people that you're targeting, they might not be Taliban as such that follow Mullah Omar, but they're against you. They come from those villages. They're among their families. They're with their families. Or you're just getting bad information because 7 years on, you don't know, you don't have a good intelligence network after 7 years. And so the choice, two things. The choice is that you have to force protection. At all costs, you protect the lives of your soldiers. Well, of course, the soldiers' lives are important. But then as a result, you might, somebody fires a Kalashnikov, you return with a 20-minute barrage, and you kill 20 people to get that one person who fired a Kalashnikov in your direction, or somebody comes at your convoy and because you fear it might be a bomber, you kill the entire group of people in the car. So that strategy of force protection means that the force is more, their lives to the force is more important than the lives of the civilians. And so you end up with a great number of civilian deaths. There just has to be a rethinking of the strategy. And, you know, and the use of air power, and President Hamid Karzai, and I saw him 3 weeks ago, it said, too, that, you know, the use of airstrikes has got to be either curtailed, according to him, or has to be really much, much more strategic. You can't go to try to take out one person and drop a 2,000-pound bomb in an area. You will have civilian casualties.
And what about this latest news, Kathy Gannon, of General David McKiernan requesting a review of the American military investigation into the attack that looks like, at least according to the Afghan government and the UN mission, 90 civilians were killed, 60 of them children, the U.S. government insisting that 7 civilians were killed?
Yeah. Well, see, this is also part of the problem. Yeah, I mean, you had the UN went, and they said that it was as many as 90 civilians dead. The Independent Human Rights Commission of Afghanistan also, the government also, that's three. And then belatedly, the U.S. then says, okay, let us rethink it. For Afghans, they then get the sense that their lives are somehow not as valuable as the international forces or as the... And belatedly then say, well, maybe we better investigate. And I know that they go and apologize, and but there is that sense among Afghans that, you know, the first reaction will be that, no, they killed militants. They didn't kill civilians. No matter what the civilians say, no matter how much evidence they present, they say no. And then, okay, belatedly you say, well, let me check. Well, you know, if 90 people might have been dead, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, do you then say, gee, maybe we should do a more thorough investigation? And Afghans also say, well, then who is punished? If 90 people were killed, or even 4 people or 5 people, you know, who's punished? Who gave you the wrong information? How did you get the wrong information? How was it that you attacked that area? Where did that information come from that said that it was a house full of militants? Who told you that you only killed 30 militants and 7 civilians and even 7? And it's still, you know, any death is, of course, horrific. Who gave you that information, and why is nobody held responsible? And this is what Afghans, without exception, Amy, were saying when their families were affected, their areas were targeted. People today, even though they don't want the international forces to go because they're afraid of what's going to be left behind because it's such a mess, not just Taliban, but the corruption, the lawlessness, the warlords that has grown out of proportion or grown so greatly since 2001. So they're afraid of what is left, but that's why they don't want them to go. And at the same time, they're afraid now of the international forces. It used to be, really it used to be 5, 6, 7 years ago, they looked at the international forces with hope. Today they're afraid. They see them, they say, oh no, please don't, you know, there's no Taliban, please don't hit us, please don't take our young men, please don't. You know, I mean, and many Afghans say, you know, when the international forces see an Afghan face, they automatically don't trust them. They automatically see an enemy. And ordinary people say, well, you know, if they see me as an enemy, then how can they help me? And so, you know, there's a real, 7 years on, there's a real need to rethink strategy, to really look at what the strategy is, what the end game is, who the enemy is, and how to move forward. Because as it is, people are really, Afghans, ordinary Afghans, who had tremendous, tremendous hope, tremendous faith in the international community, feel really, really disappointed on so many fronts.
Kathy Gannon, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Award-winning Associated Press correspondent, covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for over 2 decades. Her book is Eyes for Infidel, From Holy War to Holy Terror, 18 Years Inside Afghanistan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is back at home in New York after 2 weeks on the road. We traveled to Denver, then to St. Paul to bring you our special coverage, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We grilled politicians, exposed the backroom corporate suites. We deployed our reporters into the protest-filled streets to broadcast voices of the silenced majority. We wanted to go back to bring you some of the highlights of our convention coverage. Tomorrow, we'll look at the Republican convention. But today we start with a recap of our coverage of the Democratic Convention in Denver, from the suites to the streets to the convention floor.
understands their dreams. Millions of Americans who know that Barack will fight for people like them, and that Barack will bring finally the change that we need.
One of the enduring problems of our political system, whether it's about Democrats or Republicans, is the role of corporations in the political process. We have a real problem in America where corporations have infiltrated our political process so seriously that they're putting labels on all of us. There's not one on me, but I can say that when I go to my own Ohio delegation and I see Dominion on everything, and that's a natural gas company that's jacking up everybody's rates, and they need the support of a state administration to do it, don't think that I don't understand what that's about. We're in the Pepsi arena. Obama's going to give his acceptance in Invesco Stadium. What's this about? It's like we're forgetting the public sphere.
Barack Obama is ready to honor the oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Obama is ready to be president of the United States.
There is lack of understanding, the lack of political clarity, you know what I mean? And it's marketing, you know what I mean? It's like Barack is hot. He's right now, so throw him on your jacket, you know what I mean? And you know, it ain't really deep, you know what I mean? It's just people riding the wave.
And it's extraordinary that the same Blue Dogs that just gave this extremely corrupt gift to AT&T are now attending a party underwritten by AT&T, the purpose of which is to thank the Blue Dogs for the corrupt legislative gift that they got. So AT&T gives money to the Blue Dogs turn around and immunize AT&T from lawbreaking, and then AT&T throws a party at the Democratic Convention thanking them.
Let's ask a question. If this is open to the delegates, why isn't it?
Property, where the public can stand.
But isn't this open to the delegates?
No, it's not. You can talk to the
police
right
now. This is not for the Democratic National Convention?
Go ahead, go to the other side of the property where the rest of the public can stand, please.
Here comes an officer talking.
Okay. You know, but we're confused. We're pressed for the DNC to cover the Democratic National Convention, and I'm just wondering.
Unfortunately, I'm just telling you what I've been told.
And what have you been told?
I need you guys over there or over
there. So are you saying there's no press allowed in?
Correct. I'm saying that it's a private party is what I'm saying.
So, Medea Benjamin, why are you all out here?
Code Pink has always been dogging the Blue Dogs because the Blue Dogs are supposed to be fiscally conservative, yet they are the ones that keep cheerleading for this war and keep funding the war. But we also see that the Blue Dogs are big into the corporate sponsorship. And we're here to say that as the convention starts to begin tomorrow, the Blue Dogs should be ashamed of themselves for taking corporate money and then turning around and giving immunity to the telecoms industry for illegally spying on us.
Blue Dogs take cash from AT&T and give telecoms immunity. So Code Pink is here to give the dogs a bone. Tell AT&T, don't tap my phone.
I'm Larry Evers. I'm the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Rocking the U.S. Global Agenda. It shows that despite the fact many people, oh, the economy's the issue, it's all about the economy. No, it's not all about the economy. Objectively, with events in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, now Georgia, with Iran looming all over this, no matter who is in office, the ruling class of this country confronts these huge challenges and these explosive contradictions in trying to maintain and extend their grip on the world. So, in my view, Obama's selection of Biden points to that in order to contend, you have to show you're basically auditioning to be commander-in-chief of the U.S. empire.
Well, you can't get more inside the beltway than Joseph Biden, so looks like it's going to be more of the same, and that's truly unfortunate, but we understood that that's where the Democratic Party was. It's where it has been, it's where it is today, and that's why we have to have alternative parties and alternative voices. That's why I'm here in Denver today.
Eugene Debs said something else. He said, better to vote for someone you believe in and lose then vote for someone you do not believe in and win, because that someone will surely betray you.
that's the question, is not precisely where on some imaginary continuum or other our candidate is. Barack Obama is night and day difference from where McCain is on foreign policy issues. And the main issue is, number one, will there be a timetable in Iraq, or will the open-ended commitment remain? Obama wants some kind of a timetable in Iraq. McCain says open-ended. He will not do anything other than to say it's going to be condition-based and so forth.
It is time to take back the country we love. And whether you voted for me or you voted for Barack, the time is now to unite as a single party with a single purpose.
It's going to have a lot of hurt feelings and a lot of anger, and it's going to take a while for it to, you know, subside. And here we go. They wouldn't even allow us to put anything in here. You know, we had to sneak these things in here.
We thought it was women's time. And, you know, it was hard to get over it, but we're putting it behind us because we want to, our party to be in the White House this January. So, it's, you know, we've got to go forward.
I put my bet on Obama and get us out of Iraq.
Well, Joe Biden, they're saying, is going to be the big foreign policy guy in the White House.
I've been around for 38 years in the Congress. Vice presidents never counted that much except Cheney.
So it doesn't concern you that some of these people were very belligerent on Iraq?
No. Biden knows he made a big mistake. He said it, and that's all I need. Let's get the hell on out.
And again, on the most important national security issues of our time, John McCain was wrong, and Barack Obama has been proven right. Folks, remember when the world used to trust us, when they looked to us for leadership? With Barack Obama as our president, they'll look at us again, they'll trust us again, and we'll be able to lead again.
Senator Kerry, should Blackwater be banned? Senator Kerry, you've been aggressive on Blackwater recently. Do you think they should be banned?
Guys, I'm not having a press conference right now. I've got to get to an airport.
I know you know about this.
Okay. I'm not doing this right now, that's all.
Okay. It's a simple yes or no. Do you think they should be banned? Blackwater, the mercenary company, from operating in Iraq.
No, I don't think they should be banned. I think they need to operate under rules that apply to the military and everybody else.
But it's okay if Senator Obama continues to use them, if he wins the presidency.
Guys, this is not the moment.
The Blackwater company is in trouble because they've tried to treat their employees as if they're independent contractors. They have done a job that's been considered very poor, and they're under criminal investigation for it. Some of the work that their troops have done. And so they're going to be investigated much further by the Congress and people in the administration and good people like you on the outside.
Last question. Should Senator Obama win, do you think he should cancel that contract with the WPPS?
Yes. Yes, I don't see any reason to have a contract with Blackwater. They haven't lived up to their contract, and we shouldn't be having these private military contracts. We should use our own military.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
So, you know, a lot of us aren't going to be particularly satisfied, but so what? You know, the voters made their choice in the primaries. You got to respect that choice. And what I'm going to be doing here tomorrow at the convention is to talk about the economy and look at those issues around which we can be united. Be certain that under a Democratic administration, if that administration is showing aggressive tendencies or is putting us on the edge of a war again or not taking us into a direction of peace, I am not going to be quiet. I mean, I'm going to continue to talk about the direction America should go in. But we can't let those differences that we have right now cause us to fracture at a time when we really have to bring the change to the White House.
I get it. I realize that I'm not the likeliest candidate for this office. I don't fit the typical pedigree, and I haven't spent my career in the halls of Washington. But I stand before you tonight because all across America, something is stirring. What the naysayers don't understand is that this election has never been about me. It's about you.
Colorado. We marched to protest the Democratic National Convention because they don't represent the interests of the people. The Democratic Party represents the interests of the ruling class.
We're here to protest against two-party politics and politics itself.
The time has come for direct action. Take to the streets. Stop sitting back and watching your TV. Politics is in the streets, and it's every day before your eyes. This affects all of us. This is a common struggle of all people throughout the world.
Tell me what a police state looks like!
This is what a police state looks like!
An officer has to be identified by a badge or a nameplate. And if you look behind me at all these sheriffs, there is not one of them identifiable. As you see, these guys could hurt us at any given time, and we would not know how to hold them accountable.
The whole idea is to document what the police are doing, hopefully prevent police brutality, prevent excessive use of force. I have seen a lot of automatic weapons and held by the police over there. Quite a few non-lethal devices also, pepper spray, shooters, and a whole bunch of different things. So they're ready for whatever they imagine is going to happen, and we're ready to document what they do.
It's all right! It's all right!
It's all right!
It's all right! It's all right!
In front of me is about 60 Iraq veterans against the war from different branches of the military in dress A uniforms and combat camo uniforms, marching in tight formation. Behind me is the entire Rage Against the Machine show that just took place for free in Denver. And they're marching behind us. We're going to go as far as we can to the convention center. The vets are willing to go to jail, and a lot of the crowd is too. So we're going to fill the jails, fill the streets, and get our message across.
It's all right, it's okay.
It's all right, it's okay.
Barack Obama has the courage to go overseas, to go to Iraq, into a war zone, and see what's going on there. But he doesn't seem to have the courage to face our returning anti-war veterans and protesters here out on the street.
My name's Maggie Martin. I am the chapter president of the new Savannah, Georgia chapter of IBAW. We're marching to show the Democrats and to show America that veterans who are over there who served are against the war, and that we're not gonna let the Democrats get off scot-free on running on an anti-war platform and getting elected and not following through. So we're here to hold them accountable.
You know, we voted them in 2006 on the idea that they'd give us these false promises, these hopes that they were going to bring us out of Iraq. And they've only funded it time and time again. And they've only stalled veteran legislation that would help us get health care. So, you know, I'm not going to vote on hope. You know, I'm going to vote on solutions. And, you know, both parties, it's both parties' fault we got into this war. It's both parties' fault that we're still there. So we need to hold them both accountable. And we're going to march there, and we're going to demand they hear what we have to say. And if they're really the anti-war party, as some might think, then they should have no problem endorsing what we have to say.
I'm sure there are a lot of good Americans in there that would be not okay with the idea that they're about to arrest a bunch of Iraq vets if we don't go home. This is my home. This is my home.
The police of the city of Denver have given the dispersal order to the protesters in the rear of the formation. We're told that if that order is given three times, they have authorization to shoot tear gas into the crowd. And Iraq Veterans Against the War will be standing here in formation, awaiting further response from the campaign of Senator Barack Obama. Shooting tear gas or a threat of it, or threatening to disperse while we exercise our First Amendment rights to peacefully gather, and I emphasize peacefully, is a disgrace. These veterans fought too hard to come back here and be ignored, as we have been for the last 7 years by this same administration, to be ignored again by the would-be savior of America, his anti-war rhetoric. To be ignored again is a disgrace.
Got through to the campaign staff and they've agreed. The veterans liaison is coming out to set up a meeting to talk about when we can read our letter to the delegates. So we've succeeded.
this is a victory. We're at least at the ear of a presidential candidate. That's, I think, the first for the anti-war movement for the Iraq War to actually have the full ear of one of the presidential candidates. As Iraq veterans, I can't tell you how good that feels. Most of the time, they want us to come home and be war heroes and take our medals and forget about the war. Well, we can't forget about the war. We won't forget about the war, and we certainly won't forget about our brothers and sisters still fighting it and the Iraqi people who are stuck there.
And today is my call for a time frame to remove our troops from Iraq has been echoed by the Iraqi government and even the Bush administration. Even after we learned that Iraq has $79 billion in surplus while we are wallowing in deficit, John McCain stands alone in his stubborn refusal to end a misguided war.
Sheila Jackson Lee, I represent the 18th Congressional District in Houston, Texas, and member of the Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Foreign Affairs Committee. Well, I think tonight Senator Obama did just what he needed to do. He gave a serious, deliberative message to the American people. I think what was most important is he opened again the opportunity that American families mean something in this country. He was not afraid to talk about the fact that this war in Iraq must end, something that we have been struggling with now since this president took us to war in 2003 and since the resolution was voted on in 2002. It's good to hear someone who is seeking the presidency talk about ending in a war and bringing the troops home.
My daughter served in the Navy in Guantanamo. And the things that happened down there were horrific. And it wasn't that it just affects the prisoners there. She came back messed up. She came back with an alcohol problem. And you know her Navy benefits wouldn't pay for rehab at all. She wants to go back to school. She's working two jobs right now, trying to save money. And she wants to go back to school, and her Navy benefits, her GI benefits aren't coming through. She doesn't get to start again in the fall because they're not there. And this is happening to our young people. They earned this. They worked for this. They earned this. She has nightmares. Her name's Brittany, and God bless her. She's one of the bravest people I know. She worked and she served this country.
I'm almost 60, okay? So say like some of us that are in our 90s, like one old lady, she got so excited, almost 90 in here tonight, and fell, just clapping, passed out. These are people that are coming from generations of slaves. Then we have a baby from a white woman from Kansas, like I'm from Kansas too. The love she had and her white mother and father to raise that little black baby to be so sweet. Where you see that but in America?
I thought it was an incredible speech. It was grassroots all the way up to the level of what needed to be said. He closed out the convention with this speech. And as a kid growing up in Alabama under Jim Crow all the way back to see this result is fantastic, because it's not just about Iraq, as he said, it's about the American people, and he took it to that level.
Highlights of the Democratic National Convention. Special thanks to Hani Massoud and the whole Democracy Now! Team. Tomorrow, highlights of the Republican Convention. Our coverage breaking with convention. When we come back, Bobby Kennedy. Stay with us. Oh, This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. One of the most moving events at the Democratic National Convention was the speech delivered by Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy in one of his first public appearances since being diagnosed with brain cancer in May. He flew into Colorado, taken immediately to the University of Denver Hospital. Though his family and doctors advised against it, he went to the Pepsi Center, accompanied by paramedics and a doctor. On the convention floor, he was accompanied by his niece, Carolyn Kennedy, daughter of President John Kennedy, and his wife, Vicky. A day after he spoke, the Kennedys gathered at the historic Brown Palace Hotel in Denver to remember another Kennedy, Ted's brother, Robert F. Kennedy, slain 40 years ago, the night he won the Los Angeles Democratic primary. After the event, I sat down with his son, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., the environmental attorney.
One of the most poignant memories I have of my father was a trip that we took to Europe when I was about 13 years old, and we went to Czechoslovakia and Poland and Italy and Greece and France and Germany. And everywhere we went, we were met by vast crowds of people, hundreds of thousands of people who came out because they wanted to be near an American politician. And it wasn't just because my father's brother had been martyred 3 years before. The same thing happened to Eisenhower when he went to Kabul and Tehran. A million Muslim people met him on the street waving tiny little American flags. And what I remember as a boy is these crowds of people that were just hungry for American leadership. And they, not bullying, they knew the difference. And they were starved for our moral authority. And they proudly named their streets after our presidents, Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln and Roosevelt and Kennedy. And I remember the day after 9/11 when the headline on the biggest newspaper in France, Le Monde, was, "We're all Americans now." And for 3 weeks after 9/11, thousands of Muslim people came out spontaneously onto the streets of Tehran to make candlelight vigils to show their support, their solidarity, their love for the United States of America. We were the most beloved nation on the face of the earth and in the history of mankind. And it took 230 years of disciplined, visionary leadership by Republican and Democratic presidents to build up those vast reservoirs of public love for our country. And in 7 short years, through monumental arrogance and incompetence, this White House has drained those reservoirs dry. We are now, according to virtually every poll, the most hated nation and feared nation on earth. And it anybody who says that it's good for our national security, when European youth, as a recent poll showed, hold Osama bin Laden in the same regard as they hold President Bush, and anybody who believes it's good for our national security, when Hezbollah is as popular in the Mideast as America, has their head in an oil well. You know, Abraham Lincoln said, America, we're doing things today that were inconceivable a few years ago. We're torturing people in America. We're eavesdropping on our citizens. We are having extraordinary renditions. We've suspended the habeas corpuses. We have these black prisons. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln said that America is a good nation, is a great nation, because we're a good nation. And he warned that if we ever lose our goodness, we'll quickly forfeit our greatness as well. You know, people say in the White House that we have to do these things because we're under such terrible threat. But that's a lie. When I was a little boy, we had 25,000 nuclear-tipped missiles pointing at our country from the Soviet Union, with one guy able to press a button and vaporize most of our population. And we weren't torturing people and eavesdropping on our citizens and suspending habeas corpus. During the Civil War, 659,000 Americans died. Our cities were burned and occupied by hostile armies. And we didn't engage in those kind of behaviors. You know, during the Revolutionary War, George Washington was approached by his generals with the idea of torturing British soldiers to extract strategic information. At that time, the British were torturing our soldiers in New York Harbor on coffin ships and killing them by the dozens every day. Washington said to them, "I would rather lose the war, because this is the first nation in history that is based upon an idea. And the idea is one of essential human dignity and justice." And he said, I'd rather have the British continue to rule us than become and lose that. And, you know, and he established codes of conduct for the treatment of prisoners, fair treatment of prisoners, and humane treatment. And the Hessians that he captured on Christmas Eve were so shocked by the good treatment they received from the American captors that after 2 weeks in prison, they agreed to walk unguarded all the way to POW camps in western Pennsylvania, and not a single one escaped. During the Civil War, Lincoln's general made the suggestion of torture, and he was so horrified by the idea that he created a committee to establish a report with standards for the fair treatment, humane treatment of prisoners of war. And 80 years later, that document became the Geneva Convention. During World War II, Eisenhower was asked about torturing Germans at a time when Nazis were torturing our prisoners and POWs. And Eisenhower said, Americans don't do that. And he said, and during World War II, German soldiers surrendered to American soldiers by the thousands because they had heard from their fathers who fought in World War I, always surrender to an American because Americans don't torture people. You know, a few weeks ago, I had John Dean on my show on Air America. And John Dean, as you know, is the counselor to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal. And Dean said to me, Dean went to prison for his participation in the cover-up. And he said, you know, we eavesdropped illegally on one office, and I went to jail for 4 months, and my boss was impeached and then forced to resign. And he said, these people have illegally eavesdropped on hundreds of thousands of Americans. And he said, where's the impeachment? Where are the convictions? Where's the imprisonment? Where's the jail term? Where's the American press? Where's the indignation? And, you know, we need to continually remind ourselves that the Bill of Rights is not a luxury we can no longer afford. And that America is not just a place where people come to, you know, increase the size of their pile and whoever dies with the most stuff wins. Our nation is an exemplary nation. And that's the way the world regards us, and that's what they want from us. And when we start lowering our standards, we lose our prestige, we lose our capacity to influence world events, and we lose the soul of our country. And we now need to gain that back.
So what do you make of Nancy Pelosi? I mean, the fact is, it's not the Republicans who control the House and the Senate. It's the Democrats who do. And she says impeachment is off the table. They say, just consider the election a way to get rid of the president.
Well, I don't believe it. I think, you know, what I've said to Nancy Pelosi publicly and to every Democrat who comes on my show, I say, why aren't we impeaching these people? Just as a civics lesson to the American public. You know, we need that. We need to remind people that you cannot trample the Bill of Rights. You cannot ignore your oath of office to protect the Constitution. You know, there's no doubt that they committed a crime. Everybody admits it with FISA when they illegally eavesdropped. There's no justification for that. It is a crime, and it's a high crime. And it's a high crime that's prescribed, you know, for as the basis for impeachment. And they ought to be impeached just so that nobody does it again. We can't just keep, you know, if somebody's murdered, you just don't say, well, let it go and move on. Nobody really wants to deal with the trial and all that problem. It's our responsibility as a generation to impeach these people now as a showcase to show future presidents of the United States that the Bill of Rights is not something that can be trifled with, that the Bill of Rights is not just a luxury that we can no longer afford.
Perhaps their calculation is they are courting Republicans to leave the Republican Party and vote for a Democrat, and that if they polarize the country, that they won't have that option.
Well, sometimes you have to do what's right. And I think in the long run, it's the politically smart thing to do, because I think Americans, you know, and I've been prosecuting polluters and suing people for years. And when you sue somebody, when you say bad things about somebody, everybody just dismisses it as criticism. But when it becomes a court case, everybody begins taking it seriously. And at this point, you know, it's clearly the right thing to do, because you can't let somebody, all of these people, Nancy Pelosi on down, have sworn to protect the Constitution. How can you protect the Constitution when you're letting somebody violate it? And then just say, well, we're going to let this one go, and then we'll move on to the next one.
Well, we've just come into a Democratic convention here in Denver where the Democrats joined with the Republicans in granting retroactive immunity to the corporations like AT&T that spied on the American people. And and now all the delegates carrying around their bag have that logo of AT&T. They're helping to sponsor this convention.
Oh, I know. Well, I always say that the Republicans are 95% corrupt, and the Democrats are 75% corrupt, and the level of corruption reflects the amount of money, of corporate money, they're taking. I mean, they've got AT&T all over their bags, and they've got these clean coal signs that are, you know, up and down the streets that you get mugged by these clean coal people who are apparently paying for half the convention. So it's very disturbing to me, Amy.
Now, your family's divided, right? Carolyn Kennedy and your uncle, Ted Kennedy, for Obama. Your family has been for Clinton. What are your thoughts right now?
Oh, everybody's for Obama. You know, the primaries are over. The day the primaries ended, the last primary ended, we all started working for Obama. And, you know, I said from the beginning, we have two great candidates, and I'm happy supporting either one of them. I believed, for my own reasons, that Hillary Clinton had the best chance of winning the election, but I love Barack Obama. And, you know, and from the beginning, I was defending, you know, him against the Republican attacks. Even when I was campaigning for Hillary, they started attacking him for not wearing his flag lapel pin. And, you know, this is so ironic and so absurd that that's the measure of patriotism. You put on a flag lapel pin so you can free both hands to tear up the Bill of Rights, you know, and that's what he was saying, and he should have stuck with it. But anyway, we're going to work, and we're going to try as hard as we can to get him elected, because we need this for America.
You're involved in a piece in Rolling Stone right now around voting, the issue of voting all over the country. What are your concerns?
Well, the Republican Party has put in place a system for suppressing Democratic vote, particularly African-American voters, Hispanic voters, and American Indian voters. And there's 50 different tricks that are using of legal mechanisms that now make it very, very difficult for those groups to register, then to vote, and third, to get their votes counted. And they're complex, very sinister, cunning, and clever mechanisms that most Americans, including most elected officials, don't even know about. But in the end, they're going to end up disenfranchising about 3 million voters, mainly African American, Hispanic, American Indian, senior citizens, and elderly, the hardcore of the Democratic Party. And so myself and Greg Pallas have done an easy-to-read analysis, which will be published in Rolling Stone, I think in the September 12th issue. I got to go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., son of the slain Democratic presidential candidate, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, assassinated 40 years ago. Bobby Kennedy, Jr. is chief prosecuting attorney for the Hudson River Keeper and president of Waterkeeper Alliance. And that does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. There you can also find out the latest on our arrests at the Republican convention. Tomorrow we'll bring you highlights of that convention. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Bokadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen. Happy belated birthday to Honey. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Peter Curries are our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jay Salnour, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Rob Campeny, Vesta Godars, and Ravi Alkhani. Again, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.